The next matter on our oral argument calendar is Interplastic Corporation, Relator versus Kevin Rush, respondent. Hope I'm pronouncing that right, along with the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Each side will have 50 minutes for argument. The opponent will have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may begin when ready.
Good morning, Chief Judge Cleary, Judge Ross, Judge Johnson. I'm Ivan Levy. I'm the Vice President and General Counsel of Interplastic Corporation. I've been in that role for 30 years. May it please the court, I am going to discuss just one issue today, and that is the meaning of Edward v. Sentinel Management. I will touch only very briefly on its general rule and spend all of my time on the exception standard, which I believe Edward established, and what needs to be found. I will also explicate the history that underlay the finding for that exception set forth in the opinion.
Before you do that, let me ask. So I think Edward was a case where the ULJ found that there was one reason for the quit, and that was a settlement agreement. Am I correct about that?
No. Contrary to my interests, he found that the employee had testified credibly that there were three concepts involved: a cut in pay, a supposed promise that he would never get raises for the rest of his life, and that he would get the settlement money.
No, I mean in the Edward case.
In the Edward case, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
The general rule of Edward, as we know, is stated right in the opinion, quote, as a term of the settlement of his claim for workers' compensation benefits, I'll substitute the name, Rausch was required to quit his employment. And then the court says, quote, because he had the option of remaining employed and continuing to pursue his workers' compensation claim, we hold that Rausch did not have good reason caused by his employer to quit. Here, there isn't much doubt about the underlying matter. The settlement agreement itself says in two conspicuous places that he voluntarily quit. It says it in the first recital, the introduction to any contract. It says it additionally in the very first provision in the text itself that he voluntarily quit. It was signed at his lawyer's office before his lawyer, who notarized the document. So the general rule is established. Now let's move to the guts of the case.
So, but I'm just taking after your prior answer. I went back and looked at the Edward case, which I have. I don't see anything in the fact statement about a cut in pay or the lack of future raises. Is that what you just said? That the
no,
Edward
that is
case
what
involves
the,
that?
No, that is what the ULJ found as a reason for sidestepping Edward. My point is
no,
that,
in this case, I that was the point of my question.
And my point is exactly, Judge Johnson, you are right that those were not proper considerations and shouldn't have been considered because they are not in Edward.
Well, my question was going to be different. I guess I asked you a predicate question, then I was going to ask. Edward had one reason for the quit, the settlement agreement. Our case has, I think, three reasons for the quit.
That is what the ULJ found.
Okay. And I don't think you've challenged the district court, the ULJ's findings that the quit was motivated by the first and the second. And so, I mean, I guess, does Edward really apply? I mean, you seem to be putting all of your eggs in this one basket, but I'm wondering if you need to consider, if Edward does not apply for the reasons I just suggested, then what?
I believe Edward does apply because it meets the general rule, and I believe the court's focusing on those other two items was an inappropriate application of the standard in Edward.
Well, counsel, Edwards doesn't suggest that the other reasons can't be examined, does it?
I believe it does, Your Honor. I believe if you focus on the exception, which is explicated by the Edward Court in footnote 2, which I do not believe they put in gratuitously. I think they meant what they said. I think they gave it some thought, and I think they put in no surplusage in there. They did say, we do not imply that an employee who must resign in order to obtain a workers' compensation settlement could never have good reason to quit. But then it sets forth in colloquial terms, it's a three-step analysis. If you're going to say that the general workers' compensation settlement does not apply, here is what you are going to need to show. We'll examine then whether your facts demonstrate that. And if they don't demonstrate that, you are out of luck because there is no other rule. I'll quote from the opinion itself to show that. Footnote 2, again, the three steps. First step, step one, it says in Larson, which was a 1966 decision, quote,
from Michigan. Right?
Correct. The Michigan Court of Appeals held that a severely injured employee who agreed to resign in exchange for a workers' compensation settlement had good cause to quit, end quote. But then it goes on to say Mr. Larson, quote, had been forced to stop working because of a disabling injury and was without income. Then the court looks at step two in the footnote. It says, the Michigan court said that the employee had just, and I quote, two alternatives, remaining employed without any income or resigning with income, end of quote. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said what that meant is, quote, there really was only one tenable alternative, end of quote. So the employee was forced to resign. And they examined in that context the situation before them in Edward. And the court said, quote, the facts present in Larson simply are not present here in the Edward case. And furthermore, that those situations are limited to the particular facts of Edward. Why did the Supreme Court say that and take the trouble to write that out? Because if you look at the cases cited in that footnote, all of which can be hyperlinked right from the Edwards opinion, they were well aware that although the case at this time was sui generis in Minnesota, that the state of Michigan had a history examining these issues, had gone through them, and they cross-referenced each of those in footnote 2. And here's what it says if you go through that, that in 1966, the Michigan Court of Appeals decided Larson, which we just discussed, which had a narrow exception to it. If you click on at the very end of the case, footnote 2, the reference to page 36, it really is a reference to Applegate v. Palladium, which is a 1980 decision by the Michigan Court of Appeals, where they were presented with someone who took the so-called little hole in Larson and tried to make an enormous hole in it. And that court in 1980 in Michigan said, we're closing that down. The only thing that is permissible is the situation in Larson. Well, evidently that wasn't enough, because in 1993, the situation came back to the court again in MacArthur. And MacArthur reiterated.
Back to the what court, Michigan?
Yes, sir. Everything here is Michigan. In 1993, the Michigan court repeated that the facts in Larson are the only exceptions allowed. Now we come to 2000, where our Minnesota Supreme Court is looking at Edwards. And they not only adopt those concepts in the footnotes, albeit in an epigram fashion, but they give cites and the references to those very page numbers. And I will cite just one more case that is also referenced directly in Edward, so you can see what they're talking about. That is the Keough decision. I think that's how it's pronounced, Keough. Again, a Michigan case. What had happened in Keough? Well, the employer had offered what the court termed a substantial monetary incentive to quit. That was the carrot. But there was also a stick. If you don't take that money, your employment is going to be cut from full-time to part-time. A much bigger diminution than we have here, I would assume, from full-time to part-time. It's usually 50%, 25%. And yet, the Minnesota Supreme Court in Keough said that, quoting the MacArthur case, they said, quote, the Michigan Court of Appeals, even with those facts, with that carrot and tremendous stick of a diminution of income, the Michigan Court of Appeals concluded that the employees had quit without good cause attributable to the employer. And why did they bless that analysis? Because the Minnesota Supreme Court found it, quote, to be persuasive. I'm going to apply those same facts here and the same analysis here to the Roush situation. What caused the end of his job? Was it the standard established in the cases I've just cited? Was there a disabling injury, end quote, that left him with no income? Hardly. He resigned a job which was paying him more than $46,000 a year, which he had worked for 4 months.
Well, he'd been an employee for, what, 32 years?
He had. He had. What were his future prospects? Would he be without future income or the possibility of future income? No.
Without the possibility of increased income?
I think that's likely. I would agree with you on that. His possibility of getting back to more than 46 was small. I would concede that. But we do know that at the time this occurred, according to the statistics published on Deeds' website, the job availability was high because the metro area had an unemployment rate of 2.8%. But we do know this. What did Roush elect to do? He elected to take that $25,000 settlement, and he had those funds available to him. And after he had those funds available to him, he drew unemployment benefits, in addition to that, that are paid from state funds. That's what the unemployment statute is.
Counsel, if we don't necessarily agree with your reading of Edward, and we're focusing on the reasons that were given by the ULJ here, would you agree that an 18% reduction in pay is a reason to quit?
I would say it's borderline, but I would not take issue with the determination, no. My issue with that, which I will leave to the brief, was he didn't do it in time. He worked much more, but I would not take issue with the 18% being good reason had he not signed the settlement agreement.
And as for the testimony of not being able to receive any more raises, there was no counter testimony, was there?
There was none, and no. I'll let that go. I'm going to conclude. The issue before this appellate court, because I believe you will have to explicate what Edward means in these circumstances, because this will be, I believe, a bench and bar item that people will comment on and read, is that based on Edward, should someone who works a $46,000 job for 4 months, takes a $25,000 settlement payment, should he or she be entitled to draw unemployment funds from the state fund of the state of Minnesota? I believe the Edward Court expressly meant to foreclose that possibility by including that footnote in Edward, which described when it would be accepted and not otherwise. I respectfully request this court to reverse the decision of the ULJ.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Froelich, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent, the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. We ask that this court affirm the decision of the unemployment law judge as it is legally and factually correct. I would like to go back to the words of the statute at play. because there are two things going on. And one is differing definitions of what constitutes a quit from Minnesota's current statute and older statutes, and also in Michigan. And so there seems to be this interplay of, did this person actually quit or were they were discharged? And that was actually the argument that was made in Edwards. He was trying to assert that he was discharged, or that he didn't quit because he had to sign this agreement in order, or he had to quit in order to sign this agreement. And to the extent that Edward applies, the ULJ correctly found that Mr. Rausch quit when he decided to accept that settlement. He wasn't forced out, as Mr. Rausch testified. But the statute says an applicant, this is 268.095, subdivision 1, an applicant who quit employment is ineligible for all unemployment benefits except when, and one of those exceptions is if they quit because of a good reason caused by the employer. A good reason caused by the employer is defined in subdivision 3. It's directly related to the employment, adverse to the worker, and would compel an average reasonable worker to quit. In this case, we have an 18% pay cut that is not connected to Mr. Rausch's conduct. That is purely because Interplastic believes that Mr. Rausch has paid too much money. That 18% pay cut is certainly related to the employment, and the employer is responsible for that. The pay cut is adverse to Mr. Rausch, and as this court has found in previous cases, even less than an 18% pay cut can compel the average reasonable person to quit. Now, Edwards...
What case is that?
In Roots... Let me get the name. Roots is...
15%. Huh?
Roots versus Walmart is 16%, I believe, plus a change in hours.
In combination with a change in hours, right? Yep.
And then Danielson Mobile is 19%, so it's a little bit more. And Sunstar Foods is more than 20%. But here we have the 18% combined with the promise that he will not receive future pay increases. And so I would argue that that would make it more analogous to Roots and lower the amount of the pay reduction required to constitute a good reason caused by the employer. I disagree with counsel that the Edwards case bars a complaint or a quit like Rausch's from being a good reason caused by the employer. And I do want to note that's a Minnesota Court of Appeals case, it's not a Supreme Court case. On page 369 of the Edwards decision, it says, Edward had the option of remaining employed or resigning and chose the latter for personal reasons that were only indirectly related to his employment. We have the opposite here. Rausch, like Edwards, had the option of remaining employed or resigning. He chose to resign and chose to sign the workers' compensation settlement for three reasons. One, so he could get the money. That's not a good reason caused by the employer. But also because of that 18% pay cut. That's not a personal reason. That is a reason caused by the employer that is adverse to him and that would compel him to quit. So that's not, the Edward case is not applicable here in the sense that anyone who signs a work comp settlement can't have other reasons for quitting, which is essentially what counsel is trying to assert, that Edwards trumps the facts in other cases. There's certainly more than enough evidence in the record to support the ULJ's finding of fact that Rausch quit for multiple reasons, especially the 18% pay cut. He repeatedly brings up the pay cut and that he was told he wouldn't get other raises. He notes on page 15 of the transcript, he says, I mean, it's like, why even work there? On page 22, I'm going even to be able to eat, you know. On page 23, what incentive do you have to even work, noting the pay cut? So he repeatedly says the pay cut is a main reason, if not the reason, he decided to sign the settlement agreement. And in fact, the pay cut's what prompted him to hire an attorney, which led to the workers' compensation settlement. I'd also like to note that there is no time bar on the amount of time that an employee can quit because of a good reason caused by the employer. Minnesota statute section 268.095 subdivision 1.3 says the applicant quits the employment with, or excuse me, the applicant's generally ineligible if you quit, except if the applicant quit the employment within 30 days of the beginning of the employment and the employment was unsuitable. As I believe Judge Cleary noted earlier, this applicant has worked there for over 30 years. The 30-day time limit is gone, so that section just doesn't apply. And under the good reason caused by the employer section, there is no time limit. Now, that can go to the credibility. If something happened 30 years ago, is that really a reason they quit today? But here, the unemployment law judge found as a finding of fact, and it hasn't been disputed, that this applicant, Mr. Roush, did indeed quit because of the pay cut.
Does the amount of severance ever work into the equation in the legal analysis? Let's assume it wasn't $25,000, but was $200,000 in severance. Would your argument be the same?
Yes. Now, whether he'd be eligible for unemployment benefits is a different issue. He would still quit. So if he had a severance agreement for $200,000, but he quit because of an 18% pay cut, so everything else is the same, just that number is different, he would still quit because of a good reason caused by the employer. However, that severance would affect his eligibility for unemployment benefits, and so he may be ineligible on the severance because of the severance.
Because of the quantity of the severance.
Yes, yes. And workers' compensation for purposes of unemployment benefits is a little bit different than severance, and so that is one of the issues I looked into before submitting our brief, is whether his workers' compensation affected his unemployment benefits, and I was told it did not. One other note.
Ms. Froelich, do we need to get into these issues about, you know, whether 18% is, you know, above the threshold or not, given the arguments that are made in the blue brief?
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, I guess appellant relator, I think, has three arguments. The first about Edward. The second is about a 30-day period. And the third argument is about the finding relating to the supervisor's statement about no future pay increases. But,
okay.
But it seems like those are fairly focused arguments.
I agree. I think there are, and counsel conceded that an 18% pay cut could very well be a good reason caused by the employer. And given the case history, or excuse me, given the precedent by this court, I don't know that there's that much disputed on that point. One other thing I do want to note is that Mr. Roush's eligibility for the unemployment benefits that he's received based on his separation from Interplastic will not be affected by any decision this court makes. The statute says that if the Court of Appeal reverses a decision making an applicant eligible for unemployment benefits, that applicant does not become overpaid as a result of this court's decision. However, if the court did reverse the decision, it would relieve Interplastic Corporation of charges. But I do want to just make that clear that this won't affect Mr. Roush. It will only affect charges or the tax rate of Interplastic. If there are no other questions, we ask this court to affirm the decision of the ULJ, as the record clearly supports the ULJ's findings of fact, and the case law supports that the 18% pay cut amounts to a good reason caused by the employer. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Froelich. Mr. Levy, any rebuttal?
I will be brief. I had argued in the brief that Mr. Roush should have done something within 30 days. Counsel just said no, that relates to a new job. When I hear that, I take up what Kevin Roush said during the hearing, that he effectively had three jobs, albeit with the same employer. He had the old job that he worked for a couple of decades, That was as a laborer. He had a new job, which was in the lab, which was at $53,000 or whatever it was. And then he had the third job, and that's the one he complained about. That's the same job as number two, but at 18% pay cut. The standard, as the council cited, was would that diminution in pay cause an average reasonable person to quit? Well, I suspect that Kevin Rausch is an average reasonable person. Did he quit in January? No. Did he quit in February? No. Did he quit in March? No. Could he quit 5 years later, 10 years later, 20 years later? You will establish that. What we do know is that
is there case law for that proposition that you're asserting that you change in positions is treated like new employment?
I have none, and I did not research it. So I do not. But what I said was in Kevin Rausch's mind, that's how he was explaining it, I believe, to the ULJ. Whether that's legally meaningful, I don't know, Judge Ross. The $25,000 should be reviewed in context. That was half a year's pay. So to a person who got $200,000, who earned $1 million, that would be a lot smaller than Kevin Rausch getting $25,000. But I do want to pick up on the most important thing that was said. Kevin Rausch will not be affected by that. That is true. But that is not really why I'm here. The question is going to be, depending on what you say, henceforth, when a workers' comp settlement is proposed by or to a plaintiff's attorney, and that person asks him, say, will I also be able to draw unemployment compensation? What is he or she going to say and respond within his or her ethical obligations? You're going to answer that question, I believe. The second query for consideration of your ruling is this. I've had 30 years of experience as a general counsel. I don't want to go through parades of horribles, as some attorneys do, that this is going to change the world. But we have 650 employees. There are a percentage of claims for workers' compensation that come across the desk. It is not unusual for aggrieved parties to ask for lump sum payments. When that is done, there is always the question asked of the company, do you want a resignation coupled with it? And you have to answer that question. Your decision will affect that analysis. I believe that the correct analysis is the one set forth in the Edward case. And I do believe that although the statute says exactly what counsel said, I think the procedural posture twists once you get a settlement payment. And as the court said in the case cited in my brief at the end of this argument, employers have a right to rely on what the employee says. And he resigned. When you get a resignation, you analyze a case a different way. And I respectfully ask this court to take that into account. I thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. The matter will be taken under advisement. Opinion will issue within 90 days. We have one more matter on, but it's ITV, and so we are going to take a recess and return when the ITV is set up for our purposes.